Good morning. I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce, and this is City Views. According to one researcher, Mexico's violent drug war has claimed over 100,000 victims since 2006. The dead include not only drug cartel operatives, but police chiefs, journalists, and of course, innocent bystanders. And today on the program, we're getting a look inside the cartel movement and the industry from veteran journalist Yoan Grillo. He has reported on Latin America since 2001 for international media, including Time Magazine, Reuters, CNN, PBS, and others. He's a native of England. He now lives in Mexico City, and his book, El Narco, is his first volume. Yoan Grillo joins me in studio. Yoan, good morning. Thanks so much for your time today.
Good morning. Good to be here.
Yoan Grillo discusses his book, El Narco, Inside Mexico's Criminal Insurgency, tonight, Tuesday, January 15th at 7 o'clock in the Vive Gore Concert Hall at Westminster College here in Salt Lake City. It's sponsored by the Utah Council for Citizen Diplomacy, and we'll give you more details on that later in the program. Also later on in the show, a celebration of the thousands of refugees who now call Utah home. But first, Mexico's drug war. If you've got a question or a comment about the international drug trade and the role of the U.S. in this industry, you can join us. 801-355-TALK is our number, 801-355-8255, or send email to cityviews@kcpw.org. Yoan Grillo, how did a kid from Brighton, England, end up covering the bloody drug war in Mexico?
Well, I saw drugs and saw the issue of drugs growing up in Brighton, England. It's a place with a lot of drug consumption. So when I was growing up back in the 1980s, there's a lot of heroin there. And I saw four young men, in fact, die of heroin overdoses and complications. So it's an issue I had an interest in. And when I went to Mexico in 2000 and I arrived there looking at the story of this change to democracy in Mexico, this move from a one-party state in most of the 20th century to this new multi-party system, a time of celebration and optimism, a bit like you see in Egypt now or in Libya now, this kind of hope of democracy. I was covering that, and I was kind of interested in the drug issue as well, interested in who these drug cartels were, and made me think about what's it like coming from countries which consume drugs, like England or the United States, to a country which produces and traffics drugs, and what that relationship means. And then while I was there, these drug cartels turned into, they mutated, they transformed into these very heavily armed groups, which led to this armed conflict. And the more I covered it, the deeper I got into this, the more I learned about it. And so the more important this issue became at an international level.
Certainly gruesome atrocities happening across the border. We hear a lot about it here. How much of it is actually sinking in for the people of Mexico, as well as officials here in the U.S. and regular citizens like me?
Well, it's the conflict in Mexico, the violence, it can be very intense in some places. In other parts of Mexico, you know, you don't get so much violence and can be really oasis that escape this kind of bloodshed. But it's interesting you ask how much it sinks in, because you go to places where there's very intense violence, and I think in some ways there's a denial in some places. Like, for example, last April, I went to the northern city of Monterrey, to a place called Cadereyta, where there have been 49 bodies which were decapitated, had their hands cut off and their feet cut off, and were dumped on a road. I arrived on a Sunday. I flew up there on the Sunday. I arrived there when the bodies were being taken into the local morgue, and there was still this, you know, this stench from 49 bodies, you know, rammed into three trucks. That happened shortly before the Taliban in Afghanistan decapitated 28 people. So the Mexican one was almost twice as many. But didn't really get the same attention internationally. You know, you have to wonder why not. But going into that town on the day following that, and people were kind of focusing on a final of a soccer game between the local Monterrey team and a team from Coahuila, neighboring state Coahuila. kind of a bit of a denial. You know, you have this violence happening again and again. It's like, you know, try to put it outside. There's been one interesting movement in Mexico led by a poet and journalist called Javier Cecilia, whose own son was murdered because he went to a bar and got in a fight with some drug traffickers over something completely irrelevant. And they murdered him and six friends who were all students. And he led a movement which has been getting a lot of traction, going around and getting people to express their sorrow publicly for these deaths and putting pressure to try and resolve this situation.
Mm. But you do write about incidents where there's been a murder in a restaurant in the morning, and by lunchtime, they're back to business as usual. I mean, it's almost surreal to hear descriptions like that.
Yeah, it is. I mean, that particular one I mentioned was in Sinaloa State. We were driving along, and suddenly we saw this distraught scene, and in this restaurant, some assassins had gone in the morning and assassinated a police officer while he was having breakfast with AK-47s in front of a crowd of people. And we arrived there 5 minutes after it happened, and it was still people, you know, in chaos. And we covered, we were with video cameras, we filmed the scene, we filmed the body. And then within an hour or so, the forensic people had come, they'd taken it away, and then they cleared out the restaurant, and it was open for lunch. So again, you kind of arrive there. So it's very strange, because the conflict in Mexico has been atypical. And in some ways, this is the kind of new type of conflicts in the world today. Not overt wars between armies, but these conflicts between armed groups that are happening around people's lives and around people living and getting on with things.
You use the word transformation, that things have changed even since in the decades since you started reporting on the ground. We'll get to this in more depth as we go, but why? What changed? Why has the violence escalated and expanded? And really, the body count has multiplied exponentially.
Well, to get a sense of the kind of changes, you see, like back in the 1990s, many of the assassins for these drug cartels were actually Hispanics from the United States, were Mexican immigrants from street gangs in San Diego and Los Angeles, who kind of went back and would, you know, the kind of guys off, you know, with shaved heads and tattoos carrying out killings with handguns or knives back in Mexico. Well, now you see armed groups where you have 50 guys, some of them former soldiers, some of them former police, with ski masks, RPG-7, rocket launchers, AK-47s, AR-15s, who will carry out a massacre of 70 people, will attack a police base, you know, we'll confront the army. So how has that happened? And there's several reasons for this. One is the money that has gone in year after year. When Mexicans get some $30 billion every year trafficking drugs to the United States, that money has a cumulative effect. So it's kind of like water, you know, boiling up with fire underneath it, and it suddenly explodes. But also it is tragically the same thing about this change to democracy. What happened in the Soviet Union when the Soviet Union went down, a lot of people that used to work for the government became mercenaries working for crime. And the same thing happened in Mexico. You used to have one party running everything. When that party lost power, a lot of people who worked for the government began working for crime, and the state fragmented. So now that was, you know, part of the reason why things became so bad.
Mm. Speaking with Johan Grillo, he's a veteran reporter based out of Mexico City. His new book is titled El Narco, Inside Mexico's Criminal Insurgency, and he's speaking in Salt Lake City tonight, Tuesday, January 15th at 7 o'clock in the Vive Gore Concert Hall at Westminster College here in Salt Lake. It's sponsored by the Utah Council for Citizen Diplomacy, and you can call 801-832-3554 for more information. If you'd like to join our conversation with questions or comments about the international drug trade, what's going on in Mexico, and what it means for the U.S., 801-355-TALK is our number. 801-355-8255. You begin your book with an interview, an encounter you had with a murderer, a former cartel operative named Gonzalo, who's now serving time in prison. Tell us about Gonzalo.
Well, this was a man I met in a prison in Ciudad Juarez. I was going into the prison to look for cartel members. But I went into this prison many times and got to know various prisoners there and gradually got to people who were more intensely involved in the cartels until I met him. And he began to discuss his experience. When he was 18 years old, he became a police officer. And there he said he learned to kidnap and to torture. And at 20 years old, he joined the drug cartels and spent 18 years. And he murdered many, many more people than he could count. And he described kidnapping, murdering, decapitating victims.
Gonzalo's path is a familiar storyline, as you recount it. Young people joining the police force, getting training on, as you say, kidnappings and torture, and then turning. You know, turning to a life of crime. What is it about the culture? What is it about the economics of what's happening in Mexico that's turning people, I'm assuming with good intentions, to go against the law?
I think really to understand the way organized crime developed in Mexico, it was really a police criminal complex for many years, where the police were not just paid to turn a blind eye, but were often deeply involved. And we see again, I mean, I saw a case in Michoacán State. There was a police officer who many local journalists knew. You know, we would see him kind of, and suddenly they found out he was arrested for, again, decapitating victims. You know, he was moonlighting for the drug cartels as a full-on assassin. So the relationship is very, very deep there. Police obviously have the guns, have access. And so for the criminal cartel, it's obviously very useful to have these people working for them. But when I try and interview people like Gonzalo, I want to try and understand who they are as human beings as well, to try and make sense of this bloodshed. Because when you sit in front of somebody and they tell you about these crimes, and it's very disturbing. But at the same time, you have to try and understand how come this human being who's, you know, on the surface can seem like a normal person. They don't seem schizophrenic. They don't seem psychologically disturbed. They seem like a person who's, you know, a reasonable person on the outset, and then they describe horrific things they've done. And the only way I can make sense of that is that you have to look at how there are institutions there training these young men to commit murders, training them to kill. And it's really these machines of murder that have to be combated, not just the idea there's a few bad people out there.
Mm. It's not just the police. You ventured into the mountains. You talked to people who were growing poppies. And according to your account, the drug smugglers are revered. I mean, they see their product, opium, as medicine, and the drug smugglers warrant their allegiance. I mean, is it simply the prosperity, the money? Is it something else?
I think if you look at the countryside of Mexico, you have many people living in very difficult, poor conditions. And historically, Mexico has always been a very unfair country, where a small group have so much money and resources, and many people are left outside the system. So when drug traffickers from these poor communities found a way to make large amounts of money, and they, you know, when they started smuggling drugs, they found they could make billions of dollars. They were often seen as heroes in these communities. Now, they have a word they use in these mountains. Is they call them valientes, the brave ones. So if you're asking, you know, who are the drug traffickers, you say, you know, who are the valientes, who are the brave ones here? That's the name that they call the drug traffickers. Now, there's a whole genre of music called narcocorridos, or drug ballads, which celebrate these people, celebrate their exploits, and they kind of almost like, you know, show them like rock stars, these the heads of these drug cartels.
Hmm. Speaking with Yoan Grillo, he's a reporter based in Mexico City. He's been reporting on the Mexican drug war for about the past decade. And we're talking about Mexico's drug cartels, the shocking violence that we've seen in recent years. Yoan Grillo will discuss his book, El Narco, Inside Mexico's Criminal Insurgency, tonight, Tuesday, January 15th at 7 o'clock in the Vive Gore Concert Hall at Westminster College, 1840 South, 1300 East here in Salt Lake City. It's sponsored by the Utah Council for Citizen Diplomacy. And you can join our conversation with questions and comments about the Mexican drug industry. How will Mexico's new president handle the armed militias and the corruption? Can and should the U.S. intervene? You can join us 801-355-TALK. 801-355-8255. This is City Views on KCPW Salt Lake City. We'll have more after a break. Stay with us. Welcome back. This is City Views. I'm Jennifer Napier Pierce. Today on the program, the journalist Yoan Grillo is with us. He's spent the past decade reporting from the front lines of Mexico's brutal drug war. And in a new book, he explains the transformation of the industry into an armed movement. He'll be discussing his book, El Narco, Inside Mexico's Criminal Insurgency, tonight, January 15th, at Westminster College. We'll give you more details on that as we go. But you can join our conversation. What do you want to know about the Mexican drug trade? And why do you think Mexican and U.S. officials can't seem to get on top of the violence? You can join us. 801-355-TALK is our number. 801-355-8255. You mentioned in the book that the violence was really taken to a whole new level by a family, some brothers, Arellano Felix. Is that how you say it?
Back in the 1990s, that's correct.
Back in the 1990s, they really brought the brutality to the fore. Why? I mean, was it to establish their power? What was the motivation on their part to consolidate their power?
You can see different stages in the escalation of the violence in Mexico. When the Arellano Felix brothers, they raised the game in certain things. You know, with the drug trade, you see that the logic of the drug trade, it's so profitable. I mean, with these people, they can buy cocaine in Colombia for $2,000 for a kilo brick of cocaine. And they can sell it at the border in the United States for $30,000. And when it hits the streets, it can be $100,000 or more when it's cut up. So imagine that every dollar you invest, you're making $50 back. It's so profitable that the logic is that it's always the people with the biggest teeth are the ones who can make that money. So what they started to do was they started to wrap bodies up, get their victims, wrap them up in bandages, dump the corpses wrapped in bandages on the street. And that has a name in Spanish, encobijados. That was a new kind of terror tactic, this idea of showing the violence publicly. Which they did, and that was kind of raising the stake there. The logic of that has become worse and worse. If one cartel throws one body on the streets, another one throws five, another one throws 10, another one puts a car bomb, another one throws 25 or 50 bodies. So kind of an escalating logic you get from this violence.
Mm. Another way that the cartels have really stifled discussion is to target journalists. And you write about one, Jesus Blanconeras. He was shot four times, but he survived. He lived to tell the tale. I guess, how effective is targeting the journalism community? Is that in keeping a lid on the extent of the violence and, you know, keeping the stories alive, making sure people know who's in power? Holding people accountable, all the things that journalists do. I mean, by silencing those journalists, how effective has that been in Mexico?
Well, yeah, it's been very devastating for Mexican media generally. I mean, Jesus Blanconeras is one case. They went to kill him. He was very lucky that the assassin shot him four times, was going to put the last bullet to finish him off. And then the bullet ricocheted and shot the assassin in the eye. So he was kind of saved by a miracle, although he actually died then actually later. He did die of a cancer, which might have been related to the four bullets embedded. But since then, in recent years, there's been incredible attacks. I mean, you know, we're talking now about perhaps more than 70 Mexican journalists in the last 12 years who have been murdered, many because, you know, directly because of their line of work affecting drug cartels. It's been very sad. In many places, journalists have very hard choices. You know, often they'll get phone calls from drug cartels, sometimes telling them not to cover something. They don't want to have something in the newspaper. They don't want to have the name of a corrupt official in the newspaper. They don't want to have pressure on them. And other times they phone up the newspaper to tell them to cover something. It's this idea again of putting the terror, putting the violence on public display. They'll leave 14 decapitated heads in ice coolers on a street, and they'll phone up the newspaper, the local newspaper, local radio, saying, make sure you cover that story. We want that story on the news. So journalists are in a very hard position, kind of between a rock and a hard place with these two different sides. Some parts of Mexico have become real black holes of information. There was a car bomb in the city of Nuevo Laredo, over the border from the United States. A very bad car bomb. There's almost no journalists in that city, no international journalists there, no media. So no video came out. No photos came out. And that's a car bomb going off minutes from the United States border, which you're not seeing coverage about.
Hmm. You're a journalist. You live in Mexico City. Have you ever felt personally threatened by your reporting? And especially after this book came out, El Narco.
As a journalist covering this, obviously it's a very violent, intimidating environment to work in. And it's, you know, been very difficult over the years. Obviously been many difficult moments. One thing that many journalists, myself included, we have to do covering this is have a certain amount of self-censorship. You know, certain things you can't say, you can't put certain names or all the stories in there because of the repercussions. One thing that I look for in the book and in my own reporting are the human stories, which I feel can help us have a better understanding of this problem, but aren't really treading on the toes of these organizations. Often when my colleagues have been attacked or had to flee the country, it's been because they've reported stories which have really affected the business interests of these groups. So I had one colleague, for example, a Salvadoreño a journalist from El Salvador, who reported how the cartels were doing mass kidnappings of migrants from Central America to make money. He reported that story. He was threatened and he fled the country, because he'd really affected a business interest of this cartel. But often I'm looking for these human stories which can help us learn about it, and also looking for to understand the bigger picture.
What have you learned about the ability to prosecute drug runners and kingpins, both within Mexico and without? I know that you interviewed the son of one of the most notorious drug kingpins, El Negro, who's serving time now in Supermax here in Colorado. But I'm just wondering, are these criminals above the law in Mexico right now?
There's been, in the last 6 years, some of the top kingpins have been killed or been arrested.
Has it made a difference?
Well, I mean, it's interesting. You said that. A lot of the tactic in Mexico has basically been a shoot to kill. I mean, it's been a violent military strategy against them. The Mexican army itself says it killed more than 2,000 suspects over a five-year period. That has to raise questions as well about what kind of situation is this? Because officially, this is only a situation of crime. We have, you know, the US has been very confused about how to define this. Hillary Clinton, on her first visit to Mexico, said, well, this is just like crime that the US had back in the 1980s. This is like a bit of fighting in the Bronx or whatever. Then she said, oh, my God, is there an insurgency here because they're letting off car bombs? And then she, you know, they went back. So I think the U.S. administration is very confused how to classify this. And it was interesting in the presidential debates here in the United States that the one on foreign policy didn't mention Mexico, even though it's the neighboring country, even though the United States supports the Mexican military with, you know, spent $1.6 billion supporting the Mexican military, even though U.S. agents have been shot dead in Mexico, and recently there was an attack on CIA agents in Mexico by cartel operatives. They didn't talk about Mexico in the presidential debate, and one reason is because neither candidate has much to offer or to say on the issue.
What about Mexican officials? As I mentioned, last year, Mexicans elected a new president, Enrique Peña Nieto. It's the return of the PRI party, which held power for decades. It's linked with repression and corruption. He says this is a new generation of PRI coming. Is there any sign that Peña Nieto will be able to wrest control from the cartels to really clamp down on this drug trade and the violence that's associated with it?
Well, Peña Nieto has been in power for about 6 weeks now, so we'll have to give him the benefit of the doubt. He's a new president. He's changed the objectives a bit. He said the objective now is to reduce the number of homicides, the number of kidnappings, and the amount of extortion, rather than the objective of how much cocaine can you put on the scales or how many drug kingpins can you shoot down or can you arrest. I think those are justified objectives with inside Mexico. What do the Mexican people most want is peace. How much are they concerned if the drugs are coming to the United States? You know, their priority is if their streets are peaceful. So, you know, raise some interesting questions about how do you reduce violence and make that a priority? Are you still going to, you know, how can you stop them killing rather than, you know, being less priority in busting huge amounts of drugs, and what will that mean for the drug trade? He has got one big advantage. You know, like I said, the PRI ran the country for 71 years and had things under control before. In many times, they were linked to organized crime in certain ways, but they could control the amount of violence it unleashed. One of the problems with the government of the National Action Party, or Felipe Calderón, is they were quite weak on a national level. They only controlled less than a third of the governors and quite a small minority in Congress. So they often had trouble dealing with people. And you often had police forces fighting other police forces in a real chaos.
So you think this is a return to a strong federalism that can maybe get a handle on this?
Yeah, maybe can. I mean, now the PRI control two-thirds of the governors. So many of the places, they control the same people. And they can try and have more coordination. Some of the stories we saw before, you know, we saw one case in the last administration where the federal police were attacked by drug cartel operatives. Some of the drug cartel operatives attacking them then went in a Mitsubishi van away from the crime scene and got a punctured tire. So they phoned up the local state police, who gave some of these guys a ride in the police cars to where they could get some taxis. So it shows really state police involved in an attack on federal police. So that's a real fragmentation of the state. So maybe you get less of that, more coordination. But we'll see. So far, the new president has gained a better political consensus among the main parties, and he's created a 6-point program to try and reduce the violence. So we'll see if it can work or not.
What's the sentiment on the street? Are people hopeful that he can actually do something about this?
I think there is some optimism. It depends. Some people are still very much against the new president as well. I mean, it's a big country of 115 million people with many different points of view. In Mexico City, where I live, people are generally, a lot of them are very much against the PRI. They remember very clearly how the PRI sent soldiers on the streets to shoot down student demonstrators back in 1968 and again in 1973. They remember the repression. So there's a lot of, bad feeling there about the PRI back in power. But we'll see. Other people have got some good hopes, some optimism about this administration.
Mm. The scary part about all of this story, as you write, is that Mexico is a case study in criminal insurgency, that this is a warning of how bad things could get in other countries. Are you seeing signs that this kind of violence is possible in other countries or is on the cusp of happening? And what countries do you think are particularly vulnerable?
We were most definitely, if you look going down from Mexico through Central America, there's a real meltdown in some of the countries in Central America. And this has gone really off the radar. This area where the United States was very involved back in the 1980s, back in the civil wars, has now really forgotten about this area. And I was in Honduras, which has now become the most murderous country in the world. And it really is on edge. Now, the Mexican drug cartels are directly down there. They're down there recruiting people, buying weaponry. Now, there's the issue of guns, a big issue in the United States, of the guns and guns going to the Mexican drug cartels. And it's true that many automatic rifles, many AR-15s and AK-47s, do go from U.S. stores to the Mexican cartels. But Mexican cartels are also buying them from the military in Honduras. And I was down there, and I was talking to a police officer down there who knew of a Mexican cartel operative who had gone there, and they've been buying RPG-7 rocket-propelled grenades, which they're using up in Mexico. So that's one place really in danger. Now, if you look in Brazil, which is a country which is obviously a very dynamic country, but also some very big problems, you've seen a group there called the Red Command, based in many of the ghettos in Brazil, and they launched an offensive several years ago against the police, where they one day killed more than 40 officers and burned down banks and burned down buses. So then again, you see these kind of similar problems again of these groups. They're armed groups. They're using the tactics of guerrillas, but they don't have a political agenda in the same way as the kind of communist guerrillas before or the Islamists. They're using this kind of violence, the tactics of car bombs, the tactics of terror, but to further their interests of making money, not just through drugs, but also through large-scale extortion. Now, in Mexico, also, they're kidnapping and often going to businesses and asking them for payment, which kind of raises the question of them as a kind of shadow government. And interestingly, in Ciudad Juarez, talking about the issue of journalists in Ciudad Juarez, the attacks on journalists, when one photographer was shot on his lunch break, they wrote a front page editorial asking the drug cartels, what do you want from us? Because you are the de facto power in this city. So it really becomes an issue where these cartels become like a power, become almost like the warlords we associate in Afghanistan or in parts of Africa.
Clearly, you argue that this is a matter of national security for the U.S. And yet, as you point out, our leaders are kind of puzzled by the whole thing and scratching their heads and trying to make sense of it. I mean, what direction do you think, in the final minute or two that we have left, what direction do you think the U.S. should go when assisting Mexico, supporting them in their drug war? Is it merely to stem the demand? Because the drugs are coming here.
I think the United States, first, they need to take this problem seriously. And like I say, it's a shame that they didn't discuss in the presidential debate. This needs to be, is the neighboring country, and the United States is involved in this. There are several issues the United States needs to look at. It needs to look at drug demand. How come U.S. consumers are supplying $30 billion, or they actually supply $60 billion to drug traffickers, and some $30 billion will arrive in Mexico every single year? After 10 years, that's $300 billion. Imagine the amount of guns you're buying, the amount of assassins you're paying. So really some hard questions, and so really have to look at that drug demand and how you can deal with that. The issue of guns also has to be looked at. The issue of the AR-15s and the AK-47s being sold in stores in Arizona and in Texas and going down to Mexico has to be looked at.
And today I understand a group is petitioning, a group of Mexicans is petitioning, sending petitions to the U.S. Embassy asking for tighter gun controls because they can see the flow of guns is coming from the north.
Well, exactly. Well, the Mexican government has long been asking for a return of the assault rifle ban? And that's a very difficult, hot political question here in the United States. That is what they're asking for. Whether that comes in or not, what other measures can the United States take to stop those? Now, there are, let's face it, there are people who have made a lot of money selling guns to drug cartels. You know, they've made, you know, they've sold tens of thousands of weapons, and that's a lot of money they've made there. But also there's the issue of the social work that can be used to really turn around the lives of the kids in the most vulnerable areas. Now, we have to understand that people often join these drug cartels because they see them as the best option they give them. Now, USAID has now been involved in some interesting programs in some of the frontline areas like Ciudad Juarez, in these neighborhoods, programs directly reaching young teenagers before they join these drug cartels. And I think they're very important programs that really can help save lives and help these young people not be the next generation of the assassins like this man Gonzalo that I interviewed in the prison.
Yoan Grillo, he's a reporter based in Mexico City. The book is titled El Narco, Inside Mexico's Criminal Insurgency. He'll be speaking about it tonight, Tuesday, January 15th at 7 o'clock in the Vive Gore Concert Hall at Westminster College, 1840 South, 1300 East here in Salt Lake City. It's sponsored by the Utah Council for Citizen Diplomacy, and you can call 801-832-3554 for more information. Yoan Grillo, thank you very much for the time. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Coming up next, we're talking about refugees here in Utah. But first, a break. This is City Views on KCPW, Salt Lake City.